Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, friends and neighbors. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's roundtable. A look back at the biggest stories of the week with three top political journalists. Well, it looks like the next big battle in the COVID-19 arena will be on two fronts, schools and political rallies. Donald Trump rejected his own CDC's advice and ordered schools to reopen full bore in September, or he said he'd cut off their federal funding. Many governors and mayors said they'd let health officials decide. And despite evidence of some 500 new COVID cases in Tulsa after Trump's recent rally out there, he's charging ahead with yet another rally in New Hampshire and plans for a huge convention rally in Jacksonville, Florida. No masks or social distancing required, thank you. Joe Biden, meanwhile, still leading in the polls, is out with a new economic recovery plan, while candidate Trump steps up his appeal to the silent majority by supporting the Confederate flag. Hey, it worked for Richard Nixon and George Wallace. Can it work today for Donald Trump? Helping us make some sense of it all, Jason Dick, deputy editor of CQ Roll Call. Welcome back, Jason.
Great to be here, Bill.
Thank you. Lauren Burke, writer for Black Press USA. Good to see you, Lauren.
Good seeing you, Bill.
And Gabe DeBenedetti, national political correspondent for New York Magazine. Hi, Gabe.
What's going on, Bill?
All right. Well, you tell us. So it looked like we all thought at one time this campaign, this election might be all about the economy. I know that's what Donald Trump was hoping it would be. Now the two issues that seem to be emerging, at least at this time, and there's still a long way to go, are the Black Lives Matter movement and COVID-19. ABC News just out with a poll that showed that 67% of Americans across the board disapprove of Donald Trump's handling of the Black Lives Matter movement, and 67% disapprove of his handling of the COVID-19. Let's start with Black Lives Matter. He tweeted out this week, "The silent majority is stronger than ever," indicating he's, I guess, planning to run as the next Richard Nixon and George Wallace. It worked back in the 60s for Richard Nixon, Lauren. Will it still work today?
I doubt it. Obviously, the demographics are a lot different than they were in the 60s and the politics. And, you know, if we look at the protest, we see a very diverse crowd out there. Donald Trump's poll numbers are plummeting, and he has now taken the tact that he's effectively not only going to pretend that there is no pandemic, but that the race issue is going to be some sort of culture war question that he can win by going, of course, directly to his base, which is really the only play, I guess, that he has. Obviously, he has other plays, but he seems to always perceive that that is his only play. And it's a deeply cynical one that I think is a huge turnoff and, you know, is not reflective of what people are actually out there thinking. But, you know, here we are. He's playing that card again, and I just don't think it's going to work. I think Joe Biden's going to win.
I saw a number this week, Gabe, that 20 million Americans participated in protests, mostly peaceful, after the murder of George Floyd out in Minneapolis, and which makes the Black Lives Matter movement the biggest political movement in the history of this country. Donald Trump is marching the other way.
Well, a few things about that. One, protest polling is notoriously terrible, but even if these numbers are close to correct, you know, it shows the sheer historic magnitude of what we've been witnessing. That's sort of obvious to anyone who's been paying any attention that this is an uprising. I say that, you know, in the sort of civil rights sense that we haven't seen in a long time. Donald Trump clearly, listen, I don't know how many times we've talked about, we and everyone else have talked about his obsession with his base. It's the only thing he knows how to do. But it's very clear at this point to even people on his own team that this is not a president who looks like he's in position to be reelected. This obsession with the base in some way is not surprising because, again, it's all he can ever talk about or think about. And when we say the base, often it does mean more and more. It does seem that this base, so-called base, is shrinking. And it's people who are willing to listen and really jibe with his white resentment politics and this idea that he's not running an explicitly racist appeal with these Confederate monuments, for example. It's just we can no longer pretend that that's not what this is. And it doesn't appear to be working, not only because of the top line numbers show Joe Biden so far ahead, but these other numbers that you're talking about, they show that on everything except for, again, the economy, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in more depth, people just don't like this president or don't like what he stands for or what his record is. And if you have such massive numbers of people, not only Democrats, but Republicans, too, saying that they're not happy with the direction of the country, well, that's that. And, you know, Trump's people have always said that they wanted to make this election about the economy. But the reality is that this election was always going to be a referendum on this, the most polarizing president we've ever seen. So here we are.
Yeah. So, Jason, one aspect of this whole movement, There have been calls for change, which I think really sets it apart, right? It's not just protest, right? But we have to do something about it. And change is starting to happen. And of course, one of the things that's been talked about are changing, not just taking down the Confederate statues, but changing the names of some of our military bases who are named after Confederate generals. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff this week, General Mark Milley, spoke to that issue directly contradicting Donald Trump's position. Here's the general in front of Congress.
43% of the United States military are minorities. For those young soldiers that go on to a base named after a Confederate general, they can be reminded that that general fought for an institution of slavery that may have enslaved one of their ancestors. The Confederacy, the American Civil War, was fought, and it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of treason at the time against the Union, against the Stars and Stripes, against the U.S. Constitution. And those officers turned their back on their oath.
Wow. Treason, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, wow, everybody who was asleep in civics class in high school is like, oh, yeah. Wow, really? That's what the Confederacy was about. Yes, it was. They seceded from the Union and they waged a war against the United States in order to continue slavery. And then you name bases after them as a way of saying F you to black people. Like, and finally we're waking up and saying like, wow, maybe we shouldn't do this. And it's just this crazy thing that, I'm glad it's happening. I mean, this is a long overdue reckoning about, like, you know, institutions, you know, named after Confederate generals. I mean, it's one thing, like, you know, a hospital named after a member of Congress who had a checkered past or so forth. I mean, those things are a little different. But I mean, like a military installation, a military base, which is like dedicated to defending the country, named after someone who went after the country, is just nuts. And it always has been nuts. And it's, you know, this is long overdue. And you know, as far as the renaming and taking down, I mean, about Trump, I mean, if he's lost Mississippi, you know, on this issue, I mean, the Mississippi legislature passed and the Mississippi governor signed legislation to take down the flag that had, you know, the Mississippi state flag that contained the Confederate battle flag. If he's lost that, I mean, if that part of like the base is gone, then this issue is basically over.
Lauren, you mentioned the demographics earlier. I mean, when we say silent majority, right, we're talking about non-college educated white men, basically, right? Wasn't that who Nixon was appealing to?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So just on the numbers, there are not as many of them around anymore, are there?
Well, there's not as many of them around, but, you know, it always is a kick for me when Donald Trump and other politicians in the Republican Party kind of assume that everybody is racist and then go from there, right? There's sort of this assumption in what Trump is doing that, wow, everybody's racist like I am, and I can just sort of stand here and hope for those people to come out and support me. I'm not sure where he gets that notion. You know, this is the guy that got close to 3 million votes less than Hillary Clinton. So because he wins the electoral map, and okay, that's fair and all that, you know, it amazes me the cynical nature of what he's actually saying. He's assuming that everybody's thinking like he's thinking. So I don't, you know, it's desperate. It's frankly embarrassing. Obviously, it's deeply cynical, but it also assumes that, you know, we have a lot of people out here who are going into the voting booth obsessed in the same way he is about the question of race. And I'm not buying that, because the numbers on particularly on our last few elections don't bear that out, you know? But this is the story of Donald Trump. And I think that story ends next January, at least in American politics.
So 67%, as I mentioned, Americans disapproving of his position on the Black Lives Matter movement. 67% also disapprove of his leadership or lack of on the coronavirus issue. The big question this week came related to schools, where Donald Trump held a meeting at the White House and said schools all have to open up full bore in September. If not, I'll cut off your funding. Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, appeared on this podcast last Tuesday, where she talked about the fact that what is probably going to happen is more likely a hybrid approach to schools opening. It's going to be different in probably every state and many cities. Kids will come some days, but not 5 days. This classes will be smaller. Boom, boom, boom. It's basically going to be local decision making. Even Dr. Fauci said rushing to get everybody back to school full bore, full time is not the way to go. So, Gabe, who wins this? Who wins this battle?
Well, not to be trite about it, but not the American people. Very obviously, yeah. We're in a situation here. Let's back up. Let's make no mistake about why the president and those closest to him want to reopen schools in the fall without any guardrails. There's every indication that this is because he is convinced that his reelection, so this is all political, his reelection will hinge on Americans' perception of the economy, and that economic indicators will return to something like what they look like in February or March before the pandemic really set in here, once people go back to work. And in order for that to happen, there's children have to go to school. Now, let's get this out of the way. Once that's out of the way, I should say, the reality is that the only consensus at this point is that there is no scientific consensus about whether this would be safe at all. There's no way for this to happen, first off, across the country, because the pandemic, as we have seen very painfully and over, is hitting different parts of the country in different ways at different times. So it may not seem unreasonable for a place like Massachusetts, where it doesn't seem like the pandemic is currently as much of a present, you know, threat as it is in Texas, for example, to move more towards in-person schooling. But we don't know a lot about transmission possibilities with various strains among children. Obviously, there are a lot of questions about how safe teachers are, whether kids can carry the disease and pass it on to their families. There are a ton of questions here about how this is going to, what this is going to look like. And for the president to threaten to withhold federal funding really puts teachers and schools in an impossible position here. Teachers want to teach. People want their kids to go to school, but it has to be safe. Otherwise, we could be looking at a situation where come September, when schools are supposed to reopen, August and September, we could be looking at a second or third or fourth wave of this disease. I don't see an end in sight.
Jason, you and I remember when schools were locally controlled, right?
Yes, I seem to remember that quite a bit from the time that I taught school. that the school board and the principal were running the place, and not the president. I say this as somebody who is not disinterested, being a former teacher myself at the high school and college level, as well as a former son of a retired teacher. This is the comical parts of Trump's argument are legion, but let me just tick off a couple of them. One is that the federal government doesn't actually provide that much funding. for local right. schools. The right. amount that they send to the local level is appropriated by Congress, which several members of Congress reminded the president of this week, and that he actually doesn't. I mean, as we've seen with the wall, and he keeps on like running into like court, you know, problems with his decision to take money away from the military to try to spend on the wall. He can't just say like, no, I'm not spending that. I mean, he's obligated to spend that. Also, he keeps on coming back to this thing of like Germany's reopened the schools and Norway's reopened the schools and Sweden's reopened the schools. And it's like it's summer. it's the summer. The schools are not open in Germany right now. It is summer. and so I mean just so much of this is so absurd, and I feel like, you know, in a lot of ways you can go down sort of like, you know, Trump's rabbit holes, like even if you're a supporter of his, but like when you're talking about endangering your kids, that's probably one of those bright lines that he may regret trying to take people across.
Right. And meanwhile, just to wrap up here on the coronavirus, in terms of how we're doing, every time the president can be somehow persuaded to even talk about the coronavirus, which he would rather not, he brags about how well we're doing. Again, Dr. Fauci this week saying, I don't think we should be bragging exactly about our leadership on this issue. Here's the good doctor.
As a country, when you compare us to other countries, I don't think you can say we're doing great. I mean, we're just not. I don't think we should be congratulating ourselves about how well we're doing. We've got to do better.
Lauren?
You know, I have to say, I'm waiting for either Robert Redfield or Anthony Fauci to do the political math and figure out that this guy that we're working for is likely not to be in power pretty soon, and just break from, just go out and just go rogue. I mean, Fauci, you know, I've been on a few calls, you know, that they've had, and, you know, he effectively a few months ago had to talk in code to say what we all knew what he was saying between the lines. But I'm just waiting for him to break. I mean, just absolutely break and say, yeah, look, this is a deadly, dangerous situation. These decisions are going to get people killed. Just lay it out. Now, of course, he's come close a few times and given some really shocking and surprising sound bites from hearings. But I am waiting for that moment when, you know, it's as if, you know, it's like the emperor having no clothes. Everybody knows the emperor has no clothes. We all know it, but we're just trying to sort of maintain this decorum. And now when you're talking about people's kids, I just think that is the one of the breaking points that could lead to that rogue moment that I've been sort of sitting here waiting for, specifically from Dr. Fauci.
Yeah,
on the other hand, he's clearly,
go ahead,
he's clearly calculating, right, that he is playing a more important role on the inside, because even if we believe, as seems pretty clear right now, that Joe Biden is going to become the president, he won't take over for another 6 months. Right. So Fauci must be making the calculation that over the last 5 months, we've already had 130,000 Americans die. You know, if he goes rogue and if he says this president is a danger and he gets fired and then there's no guidance whatsoever, even though it doesn't seem like he's talking with Trump now much at all, you know, we could see hundreds of thousands of more Americans die over the next 6 months. But of course, that might be inevitable anyway.
Right. We are here with our roundtable on this Friday morning, July 10. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and pick up on some other issues of the moment. Here on the Bill Press Pod with Lauren Burke, Gabe DiBenedetti, and Jason Dick. And this edition of the Bill Press Roundtable, Bill Press Pod Roundtable, is brought to you by the great Teamsters Union, the real powerhouse of the American labor movement under the leadership of President Jim Hoffa. 1.5 million members strong, representing just about every a line of work that you can imagine in this country, or as they say, everyone from A to Z, everyone from airline pilots to zookeepers. Check out the Teamsters website at teamster.org.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back with today's roundtable, political roundtable, with Gabe DeBenedetti from New York Magazine, Lauren Burke, Black Press USA, Jason Dick from CQ Roll Call. Joe Biden doing his best, trying his best to stay out there and as part of the conversation. He tried to get the subject kind of attention shifted back to the economy yesterday with a speech up in Pennsylvania where he unveiled his economic plan. Joe Biden.
Everyone will be cut in on the deal this time as we rebuild the middle class. We must reward work as much as we've rewarded wealth. It's not sufficient to build back. We have to build back better. So the future is made in America.
Well, it doesn't tell us much about what he was saying, Jason, but the right time, right topic, right issue, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and you know, like let's keep in mind, you know, that Joe Biden is up in the polls right now with what could only be described as like sort of a minimalist campaign. You know, I mean, there is something to be said for, you know, kind of doing the minimum, giving a few speeches, doing some fundraising. He outraised Trump in the last quarter. You know,
the last 2 months. He outraised.
Yeah, Trump. I mean, and just sort of steady, you know, being, you know, portraying himself as a steady hand and somebody who's listening. You know, I mean, it's working for him. I mean, he can just stand there and be the contrast because Trump can't help himself. Trump must make everything about himself. He must keep talking. And the more he talks, the more he reminds people that they're just kind of done at this point with him.
Well, Gabe, here's what I find myself feeling a little lost because I saw some numbers this week that among Democrats, Joe Biden has like 96% support. Those include Bernie Sanders supporters, Elizabeth Warren supporters, Kamala Harris, you name it, across the board. So all this talk earlier about the Bernie people will never line up behind Joe, right, or Elizabeth Warren people will never win, it's just disappeared. I've been a Democrat all my life. One thing I like about Democrats is we're usually fighting each other, right? I mean, we're never united like this. What's going on?
Well, Bill, be ready for this, but Donald Trump is the president. That's what's going on. I mean, there are a few things. It's not quite that simple, but it basically is. I mean, Joe Biden was chosen because the Democratic primary electorate wanted someone who could beat Donald Trump. It was very explicitly the case during the primary that was Joe Biden's argument, and voters were not shy about saying that. Biden has also been pretty consistent with his messaging. He's putting some more meat on the bones in terms of what his economic plan would look like, and obviously that's changed in terms of the internal contours as the coronavirus crisis has gotten worse, because of course now he says he needs to be recovery president. But his messaging about, you know, rebuilding the American economy has been there for a while. But right. Listen, as to the question about maybe the more pertinent question here about Democratic unity and whatnot, this is a pretty clear-cut example of people learning the wrong lessons from the previous election, which happens every single election cycle, and not just the media, but also elected officials, activists, everyone, just assuming that we were going to have a much more divisive primary than we actually had. Yeah, there are a few things here, right, that play into that, one of which is that Bernie Sanders feels much better about Joe Biden personally than he did about Hillary Clinton, so the primary ended very quickly. But also, we're in the midst of an epochal crisis. I mean, hundreds of thousands of Americans have died. 40 million Americans have been put out of work. This is not complicated. It's very black and white. Joe Biden has been very open about that. And guess what? So has Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. So, Lauren, what's the latest you hear on the Veep stakes on the in the Biden camp?
You know, all of a sudden, I think everybody's name now has come up at least once. And I really actually think it was a mistake for Joe Biden to box himself in on the idea that I have to pick a woman. And now it sort of...
Really?
I thought it was... I really think that when you box yourself in like that, I just think it added a lot more pressure than is already there when it comes to this question of who he picks as the Veep. And now, of course, a lot of activists have centered him in on you have to pick a woman of color.
Color, right.
Really, and you know, for him, it is not a minor question at his age about who you pick, you know, as your running mate. He is not, you know, in his 50s. So it's got to be somebody who clearly could take over on that day. So now we're hearing a lot about Susan Rice. Now we're starting to hear about Karen Bass, who's the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. But I just think that added pressure was not a particularly good idea. but really, obviously, this election is a referendum. This is all about Donald Trump. And unless Biden makes a huge error of some type, you know, and even if he does, he probably would survive it because I just think that hopefully that error does not come with who he picks as the Veep. And it's not a distraction, a Palin like distraction. I doubt that it would be. But it is no minor question, given the, you know, gross mismanagement we've seen over 4 years and the facts of his age.
I find it interesting the people who are coming out with their different favorite candidates, like George Will, right? For Karen Bass, which might have been the kiss of death for Karen Bass. but then Frank Bruni wrote a column, but Tammy Duckworth has to be Tammy Duckworth. Tucker Carlson might have helped her case this week with his attacks on her. I wrote a column praising Susan Rice, I think is great. So they've all got their...
And yet no one yet has mentioned the two people who are actually the two favorites currently, according to, you know, my conversations with the Biden team, which are Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, with whom he has grown very close. Everyone has their own favorite. Not really clear who Joe Biden is going to listen to, except for his own feelings on this one.
Who's he talking to the most?
He actually talks quite frequently with Warren about economic planning, and I think you probably saw a little bit of that in his speech about the economy this week. But he's also pretty close with Harris, who I think people forget was friends with his son, Beau Biden, who he talks about a lot. But he is also someone who he likes talking to a lot of these people. I think he's pretty much on the phone with a lot of them pretty frequently. But I've been surprised, or I have been let me rephrase. It has been notable to me how often he's been in contact with Elizabeth Warren behind the scenes, given this assumption that we were just talking about, that there was going to be some sort of Dems in disarray, you know, cleave between people of their ideological bents. Biden seems pretty enamored of what she has to say.
Well, as we've discussed in a previous podcast as well, he's getting a lot of help from a couple of Republican organizations, principally the Lincoln Project, which has now sort of broadened their line of attack, not just against Donald Trump, but against Republican senators who have supported Donald Trump right down the line. Here's the latest Lincoln Project ad.
Someday soon, the time of Trump will pass. This circus of incompetence, corruption, and cruelty will end. When it does, the men and women in Trump's Republican Party will come to you, telling you they can repair the damage he's done. They'll beg you to forget their votes to exonerate Trump from his crimes, ask you to forgive their silence, their cowardice, and their betrayals as Trump wrecked this nation. Every time they had a choice between America and Trump, they chose Trump. Every time they were called to the service of this nation and their sacred oath, they chose Trump. Every time. Learn their names. Remember their actions. And never, ever trust them again.
Whoa!
It's so subtle.
And by the way, as that ad is running, of course, there the photos of all these Republican senators who lined up for Trump are being shown, rotated off. So, Jason, wow, huh?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, and a former rival for the presidency with Trump, you know, he compared, you know, he said, I think we're going to see a lot of people in the Republican Party, and you know, it's going to be like Vichy France. You know, like, what? I never collaborated. Yes, you did. and you know, I think that for. I think, you know, the Lincoln Project is pretty fascinating. You know, we saw that Kurt Bardella, who is now a registered Democrat, he went over, he's doing stuff with the Lincoln Project. I think this is their, they sense some momentum, and they also sense the opportunity not just to get rid of Trump, you know, which is the initial goal, but also to get rid of some of the people who have annoyed them for years. And so somebody like Rick Wilson, you know, who, let's not forget, yeah, was associated with Ted Cruz's political campaigns for years. Rick Wilson, I would guess, just loathes Susan Collins and people like Lindsey Graham. And he's like, it is better to just burn the whole thing down and let it grow back with the people who, you know, have stayed, you know, kind of true to the principles of what he thinks the Republican Party should be. And so I think that they're really loading up the flamethrowers and you know, and I think that it's like, you know, they'd rather just lose big. It's kind of like a baseball team tanking in hopes of getting mm-hmm. better draft picks, you know, in the future. Like I think the Lincoln Project would be very comfortable with losing 110 games if it meant that they got like a, you know, sort of a reboot of the party.
Well, the goal seems not just to get rid of Trump, but to get rid of Trumpism, right?
Yeah. Gabe? And you know, it. Oh, sorry, Gabe. Sorry, I didn't mean to hurt.
Well, no, I think that, I mean, that's totally right. I still have major questions about how far this is going to go. Not because of the messaging, which is obviously very powerful, as we just heard from that ad, which is sort of like a satire of a campaign ad because it's so intense.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, a lot of this stuff lives only on Twitter for people like us to talk about. They are starting to advertise in some of these states, but a lot of this is also running on DC at DC cable. I would be very curious to see how much of this messaging is going to people in the swing states, people who actually are relevant to this question. They're definitely sending a message, but this is a group of political consultants who you know, we all know because we pay attention to them on Twitter or on cable news, perhaps. I'm not sure yet that this is translating to a swing voter who actually needs to make these decisions. Let's, you know, of the people whose names they were trying to get us to remember, the senators who are Republicans in that ad, most of them are up for re-election in 2018. So clearly this is a message to try and, you know, elect Democrats, whether they want to say it outright or not. But yeah, the idea of rooting out Trumpism altogether is, I would submit, not going to be a project for only one election cycle. And it's not going to be simply one group like this running some ads that people retweet a lot. It's going to take a serious reckoning within the Republican Party that's going to last quite some time. You already see a lot of people, for example, preparing to run for president in 2024 as the heir to Trumpism one way or the other.
Tom
Cotton's a good example of that. He's one of a few senators who I would put in that position. And so, you know, there are senators, governors, members of the House, people all over who are already trying to position for this post-Trumpian era. And these guys are fighting this fight right now. But this is going to be a fight that we're going to be watching for a very long time.
So we want to wrap up and get to your favorite stories of the week. But before we do, I have to mention the Supreme Court made a pretty historic decision yesterday where they said, believe it or not, that not even the president is above the law. It's nice to be reminded of that. And only in this day would that be considered to be big news. The vote was 7-2, Donald Trump. Lauren immediately said, once again, he's a victim of a witch hunt. The problem with that is that two of the people that voted against him were his two nominees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh.
Right. It actually has been sort of a few surprising decisions from the court. Yeah, obviously he's not above the law. I guess that we should take some solace in this court being less political than we've expected it and assumed that it would be. Given its makeup, but in their last few decisions, we're seeing that in fact they may be a little bit more moderate than we had imagined, and maybe the Republicans had imagined. But I did think it was a good ruling, and unfortunately, Donald Trump is probably going to lead us into an era of a bunch of laws being passed when Biden becomes president that put more checks and balances on the president of the United States, because he really obviously is testing our democracy with a lot of the things that he's done.
And John Roberts seems to be coming into his own as the swing vote, Jason, more and more, right? Showing a streak of independence we hadn't expected, perhaps.
I'm sorry, did you say which justice?
John Roberts.
I mean, it's interesting. Roberts, I think one of the reasons that he frustrates the president so much and frustrates a lot of, people on both sides of the aisle is that he seems to write a lot of opinions to minimize conflict, to try to, kind of resolve things sort of. Even though we did get this ruling that the president's not absolutely immune, it was still remanded to the district court. So
yeah,
we're not going to get a look at the tax records this year. And it just it's this, it's this very lukewarm, ruling that Roberts has. But he still shows his conservative horns every once in a while, and which I'm going to get to when I talk about my favorite story of the week.
Oh, okay, all right, very good. We'll wait for that. And Gabe, I just have to ask you before we go to favorites: have you read the Mary Trump book yet? Do you have tell us anything about it?
I have not read it yet. I've read all of the stories about it with great interest. And like everyone else, I look forward to reading it or reading the president's tweets about it when it comes out.
Gee, the Trump family, a dysfunctional family. Well, surprise, surprise. Surprise, surprise.
I don't think it took us this book to learn that.
Exactly. All right. And we always ask our panelists to leave us with their favorite story of the week, something that caught their attention, maybe serious, maybe not, got their end, but said, hey, this is worth spending a little time on. Who wants to start? Jump in. Lauren, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure, I'll start. Obviously we're seeing a wave of evictions starting, which I'm actually surprised didn't start a little earlier. But I guess my most interesting story of the week was, in fact, that in New York, where I'm from, the rental market, the vacancies are starting to climb. So the average rent in New York, in Manhattan, which will surprise nobody, is $3,378. Now what they're finding is that the rents are actually starting to go down. And obviously with the economic situation that we're in and the number of people who file for unemployment, the vacancy rate and the median price for rent is starting to go down, which for New York, of course, is typically unthinkable that it ever goes down. But I thought that was an interesting story because I always use New York as the barometer for these things. And I suspect other cities will follow.
Is that a result of COVID, do you think?
Partly? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because now we're getting, the courts are starting to reopen, and obviously landlord-tenant court is starting to reopen, and people are now starting to be evicted. So even though Governor Cuomo has, he delayed, you couldn't evict anybody, I think, until August 15th now, but now things are starting to get underway.
Okay. How about you, Gabe? What caught your attention this week?
Well, as I sit here in my significantly cheaper than that Manhattan apartment and think about these issues, which are very important. My favorite story of the week was significantly more frivolous, but something that I found interesting anyway, probably far less important. But I have been focused pretty closely on how American sports are trying to come back, even as this pandemic continues to rage on. And I read a great story in ESPN yesterday about how the NBA chose which barbers were going to be allowed into the bubble in Orlando, where all the players will be. And it's a fascinating little window into how they're trying to pack hundreds of people and a whole culture of the NBA into this tiny little bubble in Orlando. It's all about the logistics of pandemics. It's all about the economics of pandemics and how, you know, hopefully they can keep this disease from stopping, you know, the league from resuming. I am very skeptical that it'll work, but it's a really interesting story about the economics, logistics, and, you know, attempt to have some levity in our society.
Yeah, I mean, the National Soccer League, right, and the NFL, the NBA, everybody's at Major League Baseball having to deal with this in different ways, and not all successfully so far. Jason Dick, John Roberts.
Yeah, and it's not specifically about Roberts. It's just it's about the other Supreme Court case that was handed down that yesterday that actually may have more long-lasting significance, I think, for the country, at least to some of the relationships that we've had with Native peoples. And that's the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling yesterday that the Creek Reservation in Oklahoma was not terminated when Oklahoma became a state. Now, I mentioned that I was a teacher in a previous life, and I'm from the West. I'm from Arizona. I have relatives from Oklahoma. I also taught on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. So, I mean, I think I may excuse me, think about like some of these issues a little bit more just than the average person. But I think this is a huge like thing.
It's like half the state, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a big part of the state because it's not just the ruling basically states that like, you know, the Congress never explicitly terminated the federal reservations, you know, like that were established for the five tribes that were sent to the Oklahoma Territory after they were kicked out of North Carolina and Georgia and so forth. And, you know, this is land basically that nobody wanted, right? In the 19th century. And then when people started to want it, they became a state. And I think, you know, it was basically, you know, Neil Gorsuch wrote the opinion on this. John Roberts was in his role as the chief dissenter, and they're saying that you can't, you know, overturn practices that have happened where, you know, people were tried in state courts, their convictions could be overturned because they should have been in federal court. I mean, but Gorsuch and the liberal bloc of the court said, things matter, like laws matter, and treaties with Native peoples matter. Yeah. And this, I mean, this may be inconvenient for Oklahoma, but like this is, you know, like these boundaries stand. And I think that is just like, that's a mind-blowing proposition that for as much as we have screwed over Native Americans for hundreds of years now, that somebody like Neil Gorsuch would write an opinion saying like, nope, if you wanted to terminate this reservation, you needed to write a law about it. And I think it's a huge thing. And I actually encourage people to read The Oklahoman story by Chris Castile that came out. I mean, you can get the gist of it from the Post or the New York Times and so forth, but reading it from Oklahoma's perspective is a fascinating thing. One thing that I thought was very significant too, the Oklahoma congressional delegation, all Republican, two of whom are tribal members, Mark Wayne Mullen and Tom Cole. Mullen's a Cherokee and Cole is a Chickasaw. They were very understated in their reaction. We're going to work this out. We'll figure things out. Very much a contrast to people like Ted Cruz, who said four liberal justices and Neil Gorsuch just give away half of Oklahoma. To me, it's just like, wow, this thing.
It was a fascinating story, and I must say, admit that my favorite story is a lot sillier than that, but I still couldn't resist. And my story is all about Rudy Giuliani, as you probably saw. Rudy Giuliani got punked this week by Sacha Baron Cohen. He showed up for an interview. I just can't believe that people are still doing this. He was invited and to get paid to give an interview on how Donald Trump is doing handling the coronavirus. He showed up at the Mark Hotel. A woman interviewer starts the interview and then pounces into the room, Sacha Baron Cohen, wearing what Rudy Giuliani described as a pink bikini with lace underneath a translucent mesh top. Rudy jumped up and called the police, at which point Sacha Baron Cohen, otherwise known as Borat or Ali G, ran out of the room, But I mean, it just served Rudy Giuliani, right? And so I went online and because I know a couple of people who've been punked by Sacha Baron Cohen before. I mean, the list is legion. The list of people that he has trapped include Pat Buchanan, Ron Paul, Ted Koppel, Sarah Palin, Howard Dean, Bernie Sanders, and Dick Cheney. He actually got Dick Cheney to sign a waterboarding kit. And Cheney said, "Oh, this is the first waterboarding kit I ever signed." I find that what he does is just so funny, and the fact that he can still get away with it and people still fall for it. I can't believe it. So watch out. The next time you get called for an interview, be sure it's not, it's for real. It's not Sacha Baron Cohen on the other line. Okay. Hey, thank you so much, Gabe DeBenedetti, New York Magazine, Lauren Burke, Black Press USA, Jason Dick with CQ Roll Call. So tell us how people can find you when you're not on the Bill Press Pod. Gabe, what's your Twitter address or whatever?
I am on Twitter at G DeBenedetti, and if you can figure out how to spell that, then your award can be following me.
All right. Lauren Burke, how do people find you?
On Twitter, you can find me at LV Burke. Just LV Burke. Thank you.
LV Burke, Burke. And Jason?
Yes, it's at Jason J. Dick on Twitter, and also at Megaphone, my own podcast, The Political Theater with Jason Dick.
So thank you, guys. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you all for listening today. And I hope you will follow me on Twitter as well, @BillPressPod. And if you haven't already done so, be sure to subscribe to the Bill Press Pod. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, just pull up the Bill Press Pod. Click on subscribe. You are in. You're a member. And we will catch up with you every time there is a new podcast. Meanwhile, stay strong, stay safe, wash your hands, social distance, do all the right stuff. And come on back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.